This is November 22nd, 2009, and for Taisho today, we're going to focus on the three treasures. And the timing would leave me without a whole lot of better choices than that, because we have Jukai coming up in 6 days. That's the formal, our annual biggest formal receiving of the precepts ceremony, beginning with the three refuges. But also, in just a little while, after this Taisho, we'll have an investiture ceremony where two people will be inducted formally into the Three Jewels Order. The Three Jewels, these are all words for the same thing, the Three Jewels, the Three Treasures, the Three Refuges. We call this order of priests and lay people the Three Jewels Order. I'll say a little bit about that. I think I'll do it now instead of in the ceremony itself. For many years here at the center, both Roshi Kaplow and I felt that that it was enough to have a priest ordination as far as any kind of formal order. We both felt this already is quite an innovation, which began in Japan, actually. Before Japan, to be ordained meant to be a celibate monk and to leave home, never to go home again, basically, more or less. And then in the 19th century, I think, the Japan had completely changed and adopted this priest ordination where you become ordained, but then you still have the option of marrying and having a family and visiting your family, your parents. And we tried it early in the early mid-70s. We tried monastic ordination, the traditional celibate monastic ordination. Those who were ordained that way withdrew one by one, and Roshi Kaplow and I both felt that there was a lot of wisdom behind the Japanese system of being able to get married and have a family. And so we switched to that, which continues to this day. He and I both felt that we didn't need to further divide it into what at some centers they call lay ordination. That is, the thing about the priest ordination at our center is that you make a vow to dedicate your life to the Dharma, which means as much as possible to work at a Dharma center full time. That's your vocation. And that was it for many years. And then finally, I came to feel, I don't know when this was, maybe 7 years ago, maybe, maybe more. Time always goes fast. I came to feel that there are certain people, not ordained people, but people with families, or even sometimes not families, who, for one reason or another, can't or feel that they are not ready to be ordained as priests, who, however, have an exceptional commitment to the Dharma, or more broadly speaking, to the three treasures. And that's when I felt that it was time to do what is done in most other Zen centers in the United States, which is to institute this, I don't want to call it lay ordination, it's a kind of an oxymoron. Either you're ordained as a priest or you're not, but we use the word investiture, to be invested as a lay member of the Three Jewels Order. And so the Three Jewels Order consists of there are two categories. There are priests and there are lay members of the Three Jewels Order. So today we're going to induct two more people in a ceremony, and I thought, what better time, especially with Jukai coming up in 6 days, but to really look into these three refuges, three treasures, three jewels. And this is after reading a book this summer that we actually discussed in one of our Three Jewels Order discussion groups, a book, not a new book by any means, by Stephen Batchelor, who's lives in England, called Alone with Others. The subtitle is An Existential Approach to Buddhism. And I was very impressed with his profound understanding of the significance of taking refuge formally in a ceremony in Jukai. And I'm going to read quite a bit from his own writing here and comment on it. He structures the book around the dyad of having and being. And just to cut to the chase for a moment, he sees the precept ceremony as a shift, a profound shift in one's orientation in one's life from the paradigm of having and acquiring to an emphasis on who we are, our being, that is, a paradigm of being. So chapter one is called Having and Being. I'll read some here to get some lay out the territory. At the very roots of our language, we find two verbs, to be and to have. These words have become so absorbed into our unthinking everyday discourse that their primordial meaning has all but been lost. However, they denote two of the most fundamental dimensions of our existence, those of having and being. These two dimensions reveal two distinct attitudes towards life. In terms of having, life is experienced as a horizontal expanse precipitating towards ever-receding horizons. In terms of being, life is felt in its vertical depths as awesome, foreboding, and silently mysterious. Nowadays, the tendency to be preoccupied with having at the expense of losing touch with the dimension of being is becoming ever more pronounced. In times such as ours, when secular and material values dominate social and cultural life to an extreme, the intensity of the urge to have creates an ever-widening gulf from the awareness of who and what we are. And then he comes out and says, the primary purpose of Dharma is to reestablish a consciousness of being. Having is characterized by acquisitiveness, or we could say getting. Our worldview is dominated by the notion that the aim of personal existence is fulfilled in proportion to what we are able to amass and possess. This craving to acquire more and more extends into a vast range of different fields and realms. And then he mentioned some of these. The most obvious is that of material objects. We accumulate inanimate things that seem to offer protection, security, and social status. That's the most obvious. He says the other realm is people. Husbands, wives, children, friends, acquaintances, Facebook friends. This was written in 1983, so he wouldn't include that. Are all arranged in a circle around us, connected to the center by threads of attachment and possessiveness. but the scope of having extends even further into the abstract realm of thought. And we've divided this realm into various fields of knowledge, scientific, political, economic, sociological, historical, religious. Each of these fields opens up new possibilities for further acquisitions. And this was, he didn't even as a gleam in his eye, he didn't know about the internet and how much that has become a field in which to graze endlessly for more information and more opinions to bat around. It is symptomatic of our having-oriented culture that the most intellectually admirable individual is commonly regarded as he who has stored the greatest number of facts and is able to retrieve them from his memory in the shortest possible time. Learning and education have frequently degenerated into the systematic accumulation of facts and information, now far more than when he wrote this book. He quotes Eric Fromm as suggesting that in the modern maxim has become, I am what I have. As a result, any sense of fulfillment will necessarily be illusory. This is very important. Any sense of fulfillment will be illusory because there is nothing one can have that one cannot fear to lose. This is fundamental to a clear-eyed grasp of the human predicament. And it's embedded in the Buddha's first of the Four Noble Truths. Life is unsatisfying. Life is suffering. Because anything we can acquire, anything we can get, we can lose. That's because of the impermanent, the transitory nature of phenomena. He goes on, absorption in the horizontal dimension of having is the origin of all states of ontological insecurity, that is, insecurity of about being, existence. What is it that we hope to achieve through all this incessant accumulation? Why are we compulsively motivated to have things? In the first place, we instinctively sense that a certain element is lacking in our lives. A vague hunger echoes from deep within us. Perhaps through acquiring material objects, friends, and knowledge, this void could be filled. So we set out into the world and start to consume whatever commodities it has to offer. We eat, and for a while feel satisfied, but the pangs of hunger always return. Ironically, the more we crave to possess and dominate the world and others, the deeper and more unbearable becomes the chasm of our own emptiness. In order to conceal this rapidly widening gulf, our compulsion develops into a frenzy. But however hard we try, we will never succeed in filling an inner emptiness from the outside. It can only be filled from within. A lack of being remains unaffected by a plenitude of having. Later in another chapter, along the same line, he says, we flee from our essential being into the illusory security offered by external situations composed of discrete things. Now, this is a sentence. You know, he's quite, as you can tell, quite an intellectual writer. And so this is not, his books aren't for everyone. I hope it's not too much so for too many people. I mean, I find myself just barely hanging in with his writing and with the help of a dictionary nearby. But But it's very profound what he's saying. The illusory security offered by external situations composed of discrete things, a world of thingness. He says our concern becomes that of manipulating and organizing entities, people, things, objects, commodities, in such a way that finally, so we hope, our anxieties and fears will be able to come to rest in an utterly secure world. We justify all such activity by appealing to the authority of them, the public, the crowd. But in doing so, we lose our very selves, and our voices become just further stereotyped echoes of what everyone else thinks and says. In short, we become absorbed into the dimension of having. Now, I read this manipulating and organizing discrete things. Here, too, I think of how much this has been extended into cyberspace through all the time that people spend surfing the web and playing with all those discrete things. I once heard that there's so much value in our society placed on manipulating symbols. I think it's a very nifty way of covering everything that gives us an advantage by our ability to work with words and numbers. Symbols. Our ability to manipulate words and numbers. There's great rewards in our society for that. He goes on, this flight from our existential responsibility into absorption with particular entities is a basic characteristic of inauthentic being alone. He talks about the story of the Buddha and the Buddha's renunciation, that is Siddhartha. And how the Buddha was born into this royal family, and that his father, the king, the father's values clearly lay solely within the scope of having, not in the dimension of being. And his father, because his father himself was so oriented toward having, naturally thought that that was where the greater security for his son lay, in that realm of having, and that's why he kept him in the royal palace, and his wishes he would be secure from any kind of influence that would cause Siddhartha to shift his orientation to that of the monastic life. But then Siddhartha wandered out of the palace, and his encounter with these facts of existence, sickness, old age, and death, tipped the scales and revealed the falseness of the futility of trying to find any ultimate security through accumulating things and manipulating things. Suddenly, all his previous values were declared bankrupt. Instead of seeing the surface of the world as rich and full of meaning, he now perceived it from the deeper vantage point of being and realized it to be barren and empty. And so the real significance of these three sights, old age, sickness, and death, is in their, what they represent, they're concrete symbols for the dimension of being. who we are and what we are in a particular time. Thus the religious mendicant, the monk, becomes the living symbol for a mode of existence that seeks life in being as opposed to having. And then that when the Buddha, and Siddhartha, leaves the palace, cuts off his hair and dons the rags of a monk, this what has historically been called the Great Renunciation, also represents the radical turn away from the dimension of having to that of being. Reading more here, the essential element involved in renunciation is in quotations, is our forsaking the values of having and awakening to the consciousness of being. We leave behind us those still sleeping in the palace at night. This is part of the story of Siddhartha, that when he realized he had to answer these fundamental questions and seek enlightenment, he tiptoed, when he left the palace, he tiptoed past beautiful sleeping dancers, women, and before leaving the palace. We leave behind us those still sleeping in the palace at night, meaning that we move behind the condition of ignorantly and blindly, so that's sleeping at night, indulging in acquisition, possession, and consumption. It's the palace. And begin to experience life from a totally other dimension. And so I see formally entering the Three Jewels Order as essentially the same. I think it's a difference of degree for priests who take a vow to maintain as a vocational commitment. They're working in the Dharma, but also as a lay member of the Three Jewels Order, there is this basic trust in this other orientation, what he's calling the orientation of being. It's a shift in concern, in the Buddhist case, a shift in concern from the finite and transient toward the infinite and abiding. A point is reached where the contradiction involved in perpetuating a having-oriented existence under the ever-darkening shadow of the unrelenting questions of being, this becomes unbearable. We are left with no choice but to shift the center of our personal life from the dimension of having to that of being. This produces a sense of joyous inner release and freedom from the gnawing uneasiness of our previous vacillation. I love that word. Because that's, I think, what many of us find ourselves, a position we find ourselves in, until we have made a real commitment to this way, this Tao, is a vacillating, a wobbly state, where we're sort of caught between this orientation of having, possessing, consuming, on the one hand, and that which is beyond having, possessing, and consuming. When he says the sense of joyous inner release, it's exactly what I felt when the day I was ordained, when I came out of the ordination ceremony. It was one of the best days of my life. And I think he helps me understand what was going on there. However, he says, no, excuse me. First, we die to the life of external values and are reborn into the life of inner meaning. But then, however, we also find ourselves naked, alone, and homeless. He's, of course, speaking figuratively for those of us who aren't celibate monks. But I remember that too, especially in the mid-70s when I was ordained. Buddhism was so marginal. It wasn't, you know, there was no Dalai Lama jetting around the world as an icon, a celebrity who engendered so much enormous respect everywhere. To have a shaved head in 1976 would very commonly, you know, walking down the street, you'd get taunts and shouts and things. Kojak, oh, Kojak. Yeah. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. And, yeah. Yeah, I often felt myself naked, alone, and homeless. Now every other celebrity has a shaved head. The shaving of the head, of course, is symbolic of renouncing the worldly life, which, admittedly, as long as one can get married and have a family, one hasn't really done. But again, it's more the spirit of it. Maybe someday we will suffer enough as a people that the homeless life, the life of celibacy, will be more compelling as it became and was for centuries in Asia. But at this point, it's almost unheard of in our society to take those vows of celibacy. Now, getting to Jukai. Really, all this movement, this shift, this tipping into another realm, the realm of being, this is all fueled by a growing awareness of dukkha, of the human predicament. And he talks here about this. In accepting what is revealed by anxiety as existentially significant, in other words, our anxiety, our abiding anxiety, when we know we will never have, we'll never be able to have or possess or consume enough to find any ultimate security. We experience disillusionment with the security offered by particular objects and situations and are freshly confronted with the sheer fact of our existence. We have no choice but to directly face this fact without succumbing to the temptation of covering it up again in evasion and flight. And he identifies two factors, anxiety and hope. He says it is the two factors, anxiety and hope, that constitute the essential dynamic of taking refuge. Anxiety is the cause for taking refuge. He's talking, of course, about this existential anxiety, the anxiety that Heidegger was talking about when he said, anxiety is there. Its breath quivers perpetually through man's being. So anxiety is the cause for taking refuge, and hope is the essence of taking refuge. Now here is where Stephen Batchelor and I part ways. He's clearly uncomfortable with the word faith. And I think here it's a mistake, because really what we are talking about is faith, not hope. Anxiety is the cause for taking refuge, and faith is the essence of taking refuge. Faith, that is, in something beyond our own egoistic orientation toward life. When he uses hope here, I'm going to substitute faith. Habitually, as we anxiously flee from the responsibility of our existence as a whole, we place our faith in the particular objects and situations of the world. That's the old way before taking refuge. This, however, fails to provide us with a secure refuge, and our initial anxiety asserts itself again. Now we take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. The difference here is very great. Whereas formerly we sought to avoid facing up to our being, here we fully accept our being and have faith that we can actualize all its potentialities. It almost goes without saying that when we say, I take refuge in Buddha, we're not referring just to Shakyamuni Buddha, or even as an example, as a model of this fully recognizing the insecurity of having orientation and moving into being. It's not just the man who lived in India that long time ago, but really we're taking refuge in our own enlightened nature, our intrinsic wholeness and perfection. That's really what taking refuge means. We've gone through periods here about this word refuge where we have questioned whether to retain that translation, refuge, especially because we can agree that when I say I take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, we're really saying I place my faith fully in, or I place my trust in. But it is a rich word, and it is almost always translated as refuge. The mistake is to think that we're running for cover and trying to get away from the world. That is anything but that. It's like finding one's home, one's center, in the three jewels. In the dimension of our aloneness, we anxiously turn our faith away from the things of the world and instead seek refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. In terms of our being with, we turn our concern away from the limited demands of self towards the fulfillment of the welfare of others through the actualization of Buddhahood, awakening. And that brings us into the four vows. Great way of Buddha, I vow to attain. This is called bodhicitta, the aspiration to enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. Not just the aspiration to enlightenment as a mode of getting something, having, possessing, but the aspiration to enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. The taking of refuge and the cultivation of an awakening mind are the very foundations of a complete Buddhist practice. These are the two gateways to Buddhist practice. And in Jukai, the formal public taking of refuge and the other 13 precepts, he says the radical change in direction of one's existence is explicitly confirmed in the presence of the Sangha, the community. It is thereby established with full consciousness in one's own mind and at the same time provided with the supportive and protective conditions of the community, whereby it is enabled to develop with minimum obstruction. He makes an important point here. Once present together, these two things, the taking refuge in the cultivation of an awakening mind. The taking of refuge and the cultivation of an awakening mind necessarily interpenetrate and complement one another. As soon as concern for others becomes an awakening mind, the motivation for taking refuge ceases to be restricted to the hope to resolve only our individual anxiety. How, having experienced the equality of self and other, we hope to resolve the anxiety that is equally felt by others. This faith is fulfilled by aiming our life toward Buddhahood, enlightenment, and accomplishing this goal through the practice of Dharma in the supportive environment provided by the Sangha. That's all I'm going to read from this book, just a few final words. Most of you know that that Jukai is something that can be taken over and over and over again. I still feel moved when taking Jukai after all these years of having done it 2-3 times a year. Because we're not the same. Each time we do it, we're not the same person. If we have our daily life rooted in practice, if we sit every day, then we can never be the same person. And we will come each time. We will appreciate more the significance of it, even though we may not be able to articulate it in our own mind. Somehow, it just seeps into us, and I think the way he frames it as this shift, this radical shift of dimensions, I think this is really very, very accurate. Sometimes it helps to have words to describe what we already know in our bodies experientially, and that's why I appreciate this book so much. So, no matter how many times you've taken these precepts, and these first three, the three refuges, are followed by the three general resolutions. I resolve to avoid evil, I resolve to do good, and I resolve to liberate all living beings. That's six precepts. And then the 10 cardinal precepts are a way of articulating or elaborating on those three resolutions: avoiding evil, doing good, and liberating all living beings. I will, as is my custom and my predecessor's custom, I will give another teisho on the precepts on the day of Jukai. That's next Saturday morning. And we'll get into the other 13 precepts more before the ceremony later that day. All right, we'll stop now and recite the four vows.